Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Glad you're here with me, Brooks Agnew, your host. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains, an undisclosed location. Our AccuWindow forecast, 81 degrees, mostly cloudy, somewhat rainy, somewhat blustery. I think we're getting some spin-off from the storm down in the Gulf. Except for a small unclassified cluster of a very tiny sunspot near the sun's southwestern limb. The Earth-facing side of the sun is almost completely blank. It's the first time in months. The solar wind is still cooking at 358.8 kilometers per second, and the proton count is still very high at 6.4 per cubic centimeter. Our phone number, if you want to be part of the program tonight, and I could use your calls tonight, 888-429-5471. If you need to leave the house during the program, you can always dial our conference line, which is 760-569-7676, then the passcode 192919#, and you can listen to the program while you're out and about. If you have a Droid phone, we have a Droid app at xsquaredradio.com. You just click on the app, load it on your phone, and you can listen to BBS Radio live anytime you are out, Channel 2. We hope that you do it between 5 and 8 Pacific time. That's when X Squared Radio is on Sunday evenings. We were scheduled tonight to have Amit Goswami, Professor Emeritus of Physics, but he is returning from a conference tonight and is traveling and feels a little bit tired and doesn't want to come on tonight. So that's cool. We're going to schedule him another time. He has written a new book, which the publishers have titled God Is Not Dead. But as you know, Amit Goswami goes well beyond that. And when we do get him on, we'll have a deep conversation about downward causation and your place in the creation of the universe. And there's a lot going on in space this week. Lots of excellent news, and we're going to cover some political science. By the way, thank you all very, very much for the response to my interview on George Norrie's program, Coast to Coast AM, a week ago Wednesday. The response was very good. Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, became number one on Amazon. It was number two for a couple of days, and I believe right now, let me check here. We are number 45 on Amazon and number 64 on Barnes & Noble. So that's pretty good. And by the way, it was a good kick for Remembering the Future, my last book as well. It pulled up into the top 100. So thank you very much for the great response. I hope everybody got their audiobook downloads. If you didn't get the audiobook download with your receipt, it's probably because you use Firefox. Nothing wrong with Firefox. It's just it doesn't like links in PayPal receipts. So if you did not get the audiobook link with your receipt, write me and I will send it to you immediately. And thank you all, those of you that bought the book on Amazon. Even though you don't get an autographed copy, it helps the ranking of the book. And for quite some time in our genre, we were outselling half the conservative pundits that you see on nighttime news television. So we appreciate that very much. In space, it sounds like there are jobs available, but not for the middle class. In the article by Hannah Kuchler, Fly Me to the Moon, in order to get this job as a tourist slash worker, it's £100 million. Britain could become the first country to fly a tourist around the moon after an Isle of Man-based company announced that it would be ready to take passengers on private lunar expeditions by 2015. That's only 3 years away. You could start saving now, and you might make it. Excalibur Almaz will charge wannabe astronauts an average of £100 million for a 6 to 8 month journey exploring deep space. Now that sounds pretty awesome. That's not like a 3 minute thrill ride. This is some serious exploration. Three wealthy individuals or astronauts from emerging powers will be crammed into a reusable capsule the size of a waste skip and launched by rocket to a space station. After the two vehicles link up, they will travel on to the moon. Mr. Art Dula, who's founder of Excalibur Almaz, says, "It is like how private British companies led expeditions to the South Pacific in the 17th century. We've just gone from seafaring to spacefaring." And it's true. It's true. The wealthy, the adventurous, the privileged were the ones that got to lead the expeditions to the South Pacific and, of course, hauled all the artifacts home. The company, run by Americans, chose to be based in the Isle of Man because of the island government's commitment to the space industry, which ministers forecast will soon take up more than a third of its gross domestic product. The lack of corporation tax and proximity to the city are also advantages. Whoa, that we could spread those advantages to the rest of the country. We could get this wheel of commerce moving again. Unlike SpaceX, its U.S. rival, Excalibur Almaz, has not received any American government subsidies. Its biggest advantage is its second-hand Soviet spacecraft, which have helped Excalibur Almaz avoid the laborious process of developing and testing new equipment. Sort of like the program Salvage One. You remember the program that was on TV? I think it had Andy of Mayberry as the star of it. I thought it was a great program. Anyway, very good. Lots of kudos for that. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Deserves lots of cheering. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Mr. Dula, a longtime space enthusiast, bought the kit from Russia after working as a patent lawyer in the industry. He and his business partner are the only investors in the company, which started in 2005. We love entrepreneurs on this program. The entrepreneur says this should help the company take passengers deeper into space than competitors such as Virgin Galactic. Sir Richard Branson's venture will only allow tourists to orbit the Earth, though the price is also stellar at £200,000. James Oberg, a spaceflight consultant, said there were other companies exploring lunar missions, including as yet anonymous players, but that none could start sending people as early as 2015. That's really aggressive. I'm really excited to see that happen. However, Ken Pound, a professor of space physics at the University of Leicester, said the company would have to make remarkable progress to fly around the moon by then. "I would put my money on China getting there sooner," he said, adding that as the original Soviet designs are old, safety will be an especially key issue for a commercial enterprise. Yeah, especially for people that are worth a lot of money. Everyone has to remember that space is aggressive. It's not our mother planet. If you make a mistake in space, it will be your last. Well, assuming wealthy passengers are keen to blast off, the Soviet spacecraft could also help the company break even quickly, Mr. Dula said. The startup costs should be covered between the first and second flight, he said, after which it targets a 50% return on investment in 3 years. Sounds pretty good for the two entrepreneurs that got it started. Tickets for the historic flight will cost around 150 million pounds, with the price falling to about 50 million pounds after 10 years. Adventurers will have to submit to 6 months of full-time training with the California company X Corp. As well as marketing to rich space fanatics, the company is in talks with three emerging economies who want the prestige of sending someone to space without the expense of developing their own space programs. Well, come on. The Jamaicans excelled at downhill luge with the Winter Olympics, which you wouldn't expect from Jamaicans. So why not Jamaicans in space? Come on. The company also hopes to drive revenues by emblazoned adverts across its space station. Could be cool. I mean, come on, having a big, you know, McDonald's ad heading for the moon, that would boost sales, maybe. Conducting research for universities and pharmaceutical companies, I'm sure. You know, Libby, Pfizer, I'm sure those satellites have cameras on them as you go scooting by those DirecTV satellites out there, 23,500 miles into space. It's possible that it could result in purchases of more drugs, maybe, and allowing other expeditions, including government astronauts from countries like China, to rent the space station. But space brings a new universe into reach for people. It also brings a risk for investors. Everyone has to remember that space is aggressive, and your first mistake is going to be your last. Still, I've been asked often, if I were offered a seat on the space shuttle, would I go? And my answer is, my bag is packed before you finish the question. Of course I would go. Yes, there are risks, but how many people get to see the Earth from the portal window from out in space? And 200 miles is cool, but 200,000 miles is even cooler. Around the moon. Could be interesting. And you might not be alone up there either. Might get some much more interesting unclassified pictures out the portal. Any thoughts on that? 888-429-5471. If cost were not an issue, would you go? Would you take a seat? 888-429-5471. Give me a call. We'll talk about that subject. On, I have, by the way, a Drone Wars update. Because, I mean, there's just a lot of interesting stuff about this. Since we brought the subject up about 6 months ago, I think it was when the Iranians used the Chinese backdoor and the firmware of the drone that was flying over Iran, and they hacked into it and steered it to the ground and landed it virtually intact. I think it was a little bit of a rough landing. It might have messed the landing gear up, but the drone was pretty much intact and all the electronics in it were fully functional. As it turns out, all the chips that run all the hardware and firmware, because of cost considerations, and amazingly, because of free trade agreements that the agency government has signed, all the chip manufacturers in the United States mysteriously, unexpectedly, went broke. And they shipped all the chip manufacturing to China. Well, as luck would have it, the chips came in perfectly fine, passed all the tests, everything was good. They got mounted on the boards, put into the drones, launched out over Iran, and guess what? That's right, the chips had firmware in them. That's not the software. That's a little hard-written code on the chip that allows people with access codes to enter into the software from a backdoor. Once the codes are given out from, say, China to Iran, it's very simple for an amateur hacker to hack into the flight controls, not necessarily the data stream, but hack into the simple flight controls, take over the joystick, and just fly it to the ground, which I'm sure was done. Now, I'm sure that the operators that sit at Nellis Air Force Base and fly these things on a flat-screen, high-definition TV are much better at it because they have a lot more training at it. And the ones in Iran don't have any training at all, except for maybe an Xbox and some, you know, flight simulation software. But they were able to land it without it cartwheeling across the tumbleweeds of the desert. They landed it pretty much intact. And I doubt we'll ever see it back, even though the president, you know, very politely, I would say meekly, asked for it back. But that's okay. The drone wars continue. And there is a new prospect, and we've talked about it on this program before, but there's a new dimension to it. The prospect is that 30,000 drones, I want that number to sink in just for a moment, because there are only 50 states. Two of them are not mainstream. That is to say, they're not main continent, Alaska and Hawaii. Who wants to fly drones over Hawaii? Like, why? It takes you an hour and a half to drive around the island. You're not going to fly drones over the island of Hawaii. And you're probably, the only reason to fly one over Alaska is to check for forest fires, because you can probably do that by satellite, but, you know, maybe you want a little early warning on the forest fires. And I don't know if there's that many neat places to land drones in Alaska anyway. So we're talking about 48 states, 30,000 drones. Think about it. That's pretty close to 700 drones per state. 700 drones. Now, some states won't need very many. But some states will need a lot. Florida, New York, North Carolina, California, Texas, maybe the border states, northern and southern, and maybe a little bit of flyover country. The problem is that these drones are going to be equipped with high-tech cameras, and they're going to be looking at the ground and watching what you do. Yes, I'm sure that there is going to be legislation in place that says, oh, they have to have a mission, and they got to be going after specific stuff. And if they should happen to look out the rearview mirror or the side portal and see something that's not on the list, it's not on the warrant, not on the absolute manifest of this mission, well, they can't use it. Yeah, I'm sure that will happen. Oh, by the way, we saw some illegal activity out our side window. And you know how long it would take them to get a warrant and send the boys in black in there to check it out? Yeah, about 10 minutes flat. And the process will get faster and faster as the halls and the ability to put people in jail and to levy huge fines against polluters, against hunters, against speeders, against people who are developing real estate in the wilderness without a permit, you know, those kinds of things, will be directly proportional to the speed with which drones are adopted. I can tell you right now that municipalities, sheriffs, and also state troopers, applications for drones, leasing and or purchasing is stacking up every day, because they know how much it costs to put a highway patrol person or a state trooper out on the freeway patrolling the roads. Now, yeah, I know they call it traffic enforcement, but you know, and I know, it's traffic revenueing. It's a speed tax. And you know that the way the system has worked in the past, they got to be within eyesight of you. They got to catch you on radar. They got to have a picture of your vehicle, blah, blah, blah. The trooper has to go to court. He has to show up if you're going to fight it and say, yeah, he was speeding. And, you know, here's the copy of the ticket with their signature on it. You know how the story goes if you've ever had a speeding ticket. And I'm sure if you drive a lot of freeway driving, you've had one. Because if you want to keep up with the flow of traffic, you are going to have to speed sooner or later. And it's just the odds, the way they pull over cars, 3, 4, 10 at a time. Sometimes they'll have a spotter car and then 10 to 12 cars on up the road, and they'll just identify you by license plate, send the snapshot to the car at the next on-ramp, and they'll pull you over. You know how expensive that is. They know how expensive that is, and they pull in $75,000 to $125,000 a week. That's not too bad when you got a judge to pay for and the court clerk and the troopers and the fuel and all of that, and you don't want to raise taxes. You got to go revenueing. And you got all these tourists and other people driving through your county on state road or federal roads. You might as well take advantage of it, and they do. But if you could put a drone up there and fly it for 8 to 10 hours up there and just identify cars from the air and send the cameras on to one or two patrol cars up the road, the haul could be 10 times as much. It doesn't take much of a city manager to put the numbers together. Sooner or later, they're going to say, hey, we take in $25,000, maybe $30,000 a week, and we have to pay the expenses of the troopers being out there. Now we don't. Now we just need, you know, regular patrol cars, and we catch them with drones, and we can increase our revenues by 10, 15 times. And that's why they've asked for the drones. Now, they say that it's for law enforcement. They say that it's, you know, to keep their county safe and all of that. But it's about the money. Let's be serious. Well, it has a lot of people upset, okay? By the end of the decade, it's raising the specter of a big brother government that peers into backyards and bedrooms. Because it's not just visible cameras that go on these drones. It's infrared. Yeah, they can see at night. They can see through smoke, rain. You know, sometimes you get a low overcast day. You know, there's no airplane up there monitoring that freeway. So you kick it up 8 to 10 miles an hour and you get there an hour or 2 hours earlier. But now that's not the case. You can fly a drone at 15,000 feet. You'll never see it in a million years, not even with a pair of binoculars, especially at night. But they see you, and they can take a picture of you. And with the right monitoring equipment, they can monitor your cell phone calls from up there. They can monitor your GPS in your vehicle and even relay your actual speed from your own GPS up to the unit and tell exactly how fast you've been going, how long you've been traveling at that speed. Oh, yeah, all that information's there. You just look at your GPS and you'll see all the incriminating evidence that you need. You know that little red flag up in the right-hand corner that says speed limit 55, you're doing 75? That little red flag means that you're speeding. That's all the information that drone needs. You're already sending out all the electronic information they need to incriminate you. Well, the worries began mostly on the political margins, you know, out there toward the edge of the bell curve. But there are signs that ordinary people, you know, like you and me, are starting to fret that unmanned aircraft could soon be circling overhead. Jeff Landry, a freshman Republican congressman from Louisiana's coastal bayou country, said constituents have stopped him while shopping at, of all places, Walmart, to talk about it. There is a distrust among the people who have come and discussed this issue with him about our government. Landry goes on to say, it's raising an alarm with the American people. Well, it should, because it is against the Constitution of the United States for federal weapons to be used to monitor or control the American people. And a drone was specifically designed and paid for with federal money as a federal weapons system. And so it's being used against Americans. Another GOP freshman, Representative Austin Scott, said he first learned of the issue when someone shouted out a question about drones at a Republican Party meeting in his Georgia congressional district 2 months ago. An American Civil Liberties Union lobbyist, Chris Calabrese, said that when he speaks to audience about privacy issues generally, drones are what everybody just perks up over. It doesn't make sense to us. People are interested in the technology. They're interested in the applications. And they worry about being under surveillance from the skies. But what do you have to hide if you're doing nothing wrong? The level of apprehension is especially high in the conservative blogosphere. Well, there's a new coined word. Where do you live? I live in the blogosphere. It's the sphere above, where headlines blare, 30,000 armed drones to be used against Americans. Well, not exactly, and not yet. Yes, these are the Predator drones, $14 million a copy. Yes, they can carry Hellfire missiles. Yes, they can carry all kinds of explosive 40-millimeter rounds. You know, the same kind that have done all the assassination work for us overseas. But they don't have to be. Just because they can be armed doesn't mean that they will be armed. Yet. And the other headline is, government drones set to spy on farms in the United States. It's true. It's true. You know, it costs a lot to fly those black helicopters up there. And they have the infrared cameras so that they can spot those pot farms out in the middle of the corn. They have those special cameras or special sensors that pick up the pollen above your field to make sure you're growing the government-approved seed, to make sure that there's nothing nefarious going on in the darkness of the forests behind your remote property. When Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, a Republican, suggested during a radio interview last month that drones be used by police domestically, since they've done such a good job on foreign battlefields, the political backlash was swift. NetRight Daily complained, quote, "This seems like something a fascist would do. McDonnell isn't pro-big government. He is pro-huge government." John Whitehead, president of the Rutherford Institute of Charlottesville, Virginia, which provides legal assistance in support of civil liberties and conservative causes, warned the governor, "America is not a battlefield, and the citizens of this nation are not insurgents in need of vanquishing." And by the way, it's not just American citizens that are interested in this, not at all. We have listeners in Slovenia right now. Right now, they're listening. And even though they live in another country, they have the same fears of being watched from the sky, being spied upon, plans being made by people behind those monitors somewhere. Somebody is watching this stuff. Somebody knows who's moving around. And who's to decide who's an enemy of the state and who is not? I mean, seriously, people. In this country, inside certain circles, Republicans are considered enemies of the state. Inside this country, those of you that belong to AMAC, that's the new organization for conservative elderly people, people over 50 years old. It's an alternative to the AARP. I am not a member of the AARP because I don't want my email address, I don't want my dues being used in Washington for their agenda, which I know very well. AMAC is a completely different organization made up of conservative people our age. And now they're over 200,000 strong and growing. And I spoke to the people who run AMAC, and they have already said that their servers have been under attack, that their website has been hacked into and shut down several times, that people are not getting their membership information after spending the money, because the flow of the money is being interrupted by hackers. Yeah, they're working through it because they have smart people working for them too. But that just lets you know that there are more people that are law-abiding people, that are entrepreneurs, thinkers, dreamers, explorers, listeners to this program. And they're not enemies of the state. But if we talk about things from the wrong point of view, maybe we become enemies of the state. Maybe we get on the flyover list for the drones. Giving drones greater access to U.S. skies moves the nation closer to a surveillance society in which our every move is monitored, tracked, recorded, and scrutinized by the authorities, the ACLU warned last December in a report. Many people call this, and I do in the book Alienated Nation, I'm not the first to think of it, but it's such a fantastic term. I can't leave it alone. One nation under surveillance. The anxiety has spilled over into Congress, where a bipartisan group of lawmakers has been meeting to discuss legislation that would broadly address the civil liberty issues raised by drones. A Landry provision in a defense spending bill would prohibit information gathered by military drones without a warrant, from being issued as evidence in court. I told you that can be fixed in 15 minutes. Any state attorney general, if he thinks there are crimes being committed in his state, if the attorney general, you know, Withholder, I'm sorry, Holder, were to say, we think there's illegal activity going on in this county in your state, we're going to authorize drone flights over. And if we find any illegal activity, we'll hand it over to you so that you can take action. And if you don't, we will. I guarantee you that would take about 15 minutes if they thought there was a way that they could prevent a unlawful assembly from occurring, if they could prevent voters who might vote against them from organizing in some way. A provision that Representative Rush Holt, Democrat from New Jersey, added to another bill would prohibit the Homeland Security Department from arming its drones, including ones to patrol the border. Well, I don't think they can do that. I think you can put bills in there to try to keep weapons off of them. But the first time, and I guarantee this is going to happen, because we have had the audio on this program several times of our good friend Charles Krauthammer. I might be able to just pull that up really fast because I think it would be important that you hear it. One of the things that is interesting about this program is we can put audio in here that helps people, you know, put things in perspective. I just want you to listen to this just a little bit. See what you think.
In this country. The first guy who uses a Second Amendment weapon to bring a drone down that's been hovering over his house is going to be a folk hero in this country. I don't want regulations. I don't want restrictions. I want a ban on this. A folk hero in this country. Drones are instruments of war. The founders had a great aversion to any instruments of war, the use of the military, inside of the United States. They didn't like standing armies. A folk hero in this country. It has all kinds of statutes against using the army in the country. A drone is a high-tech version of an old army in a musket. A folk hero in this country. It ought to be used in Somalia to hunt the bad guys, but not in America. I don't want to see it hovering over anybody's home. A folk hero in this country. Yes, you can say we've got satellites, we've got Google Street, and London has a camera on every street corner, but that's not excuse to cave in on everything else and accept a society where you're always under being watched by the government. They're a folk hero in this country. This is not what we want. I would say you ban it under all circumstances, and I would predict, I'm not encouraging, but I'm predicting the first guy who uses a Second Amendment weapon to bring a drone down that's been hovering over his house is going to be a folk hero in this country.
I don't know if you can do that. Aren't they awfully high up?
Well, you may have to use a lot of them. You may have to use a very high-powered one. You may have to use a bazooka. I'm not encouraging. I'm simply making a prediction.
A libertarian.
A folk hero in this country. Hero.
He's stepping up.
Left-wing. A folk hero in this country.
Well, there you go. So, if Charles Krauthammer is right, and he has... maybe unwittingly, although I doubt he ever does anything unwittingly, has authorized Americans with a Second Amendment weapon. You know what that is, don't you? That would be a high-powered firearm, a shotgun, something like that, if you can get to it. Shoots down a drone that is flying over his property, downs that thing. He's going to be a folk hero. And let me tell you what else he's going to be. He's going to be on the FBI's most wanted list. Because if you shoot down a $14 million drone with a .30-06 rifle, your duck hunting group goes out with high-powered rifles just in case a drone should happen to fly over and shoots that thing down for target practice. You think what we see in Syria is bad? Wait till you see that escalate. You shoot down a $14 million drone, and more drones will come after it. Armed or not, nobody likes federal weapons flying over American airspace, regardless of what Congress or the Homeland Security puts in place. Now, the leaders of Homeland Security think that the American people are the greatest threat to America right now. And we just simply do not believe that. We believe that the people of the United States are the United States, that the government that makes, that calls itself the federal government, which isn't really the elected government at all, but a collection of agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations, is there to govern. It's not there to rule. And increasingly, Americans get the feeling, and other nations too, feel that the American government, the not the ones that's elected, because I think those are largely, and I say largely with a capital L, good men and good women that are elected on a local level and sent to Washington to represent their constituents. Yes, there are probably 50 or maybe even 75 of them up there that need to be removed. I mean, they're absolute activists. They don't know what the Constitution is. They don't believe in the Constitution. They are up there for their own agenda, and heaven only knows how they get elected, reelected over and over again, but they do. 50 or 75 of them fall into that category. The rest of the 435, I haven't met them all, but I've met a lot of them, and they're good men, and they're good women. They're people, they're citizens of high report, and they're doing their best. But their hands are tied because of 600 regulations a month being shoved down their throats by the agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus that have the force of law. The Congress had no say-so in writing. They have no purview. They have no ability to repeal any of these rules, any of these regulations. And the people are not represented. They didn't elect these people. And they're being taxed, and they're being fined, and they're being fined, and they're being enforced by a non-representative government. It's that government, the Homeland Security government, the EPA government, the FDA government. Okay? The NEA, and it goes on and on. ATF, we've already seen what that debacle can do. So we have all that going on, and what can we do about it? Well, we can do something about it. We go to the polls and we try to do something about it, but this is beyond the polls. This stuff is taking place off the grid as far as legislation. This is taking place in the courtrooms. This is what we call litigious legislation. And these are being done by lawmakers, literally lawmakers who are not elected. And there are lots of people that are not not supporting of this. For instance, Scott and Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, have introduced identical bills to prohibit any government agency. That's a real important term. Any government agency from using a drone to gather evidence or other information pertaining to criminal conduct or conduct in violation of a regulation without a warrant. In other words, you got to have a warrant. You got to have a specific flight plan. You have to have a specific circle of target where that drone is going to be turned on and then turned off, and you have to have a warrant from a judge in advance. Most of the time we send drones in because it's too dangerous to send a policeman in, and we don't want to endanger his life. If there's a situation where law enforcement believes that their lives will be put in danger, like death, from going in and gathering information, then by all means use a drone. But to fly drones 8, 10, 14 hours a day, 5 days a week, 7 days a week, constant surveillance over an area, just looking for something to go wrong, that is an overreach of the law, and that needs to be stopped. And I'm sure that Senator Rand and Scott's bill is going to take care of that. I just don't like the concept of drones flying over barbecues in New York to see whether you have a big gulp in your backyard or whether you are separating out your recyclables according to city mandates, Paul said in an interview, referring to a New York City ban on supersized soft drinks. It gets worse than that. You fly over New Mexico to make sure that people aren't gathering out in the wilderness to practice with firearms or do paramilitary activities. They don't want you flying over Montana to see what the militia of Montana is doing. They don't want you flying over Nebraska to see what the farmers are doing out in the middle of the cornfields trying to organize, trying to put together their support and their voting bloc against the powers of Monsanto. They don't want you seeing that. And quite frankly, once you open Pandora's box, you let the elephant's nose into the tent. You let those drones start flying over. You let one single major crime be averted or solved by using those drones, and you'll never go back. You will never get those drones out of the sky. And like I said, if Charles Krauthammer is right, and somebody uses a bazooka or a 40-millimeter grenade launcher or a 30-06 or an 8-millimeter Mauser or a shotgun with a slug in it, and they shoot down a drone, whether it's a $500,000 drone or a $14 million drone. And if it was me, I'd have it on eBay in 45 minutes. But you're going to see the windows of hell open up on that area. Nobody will escape there without going to jail. That's the kind of altercation that I think the federal government has been looking for. With as bad as things have gotten, with this election, everything hanging in the balance, literally two ideologies. One is that the federal government is the ultimate ruler in the country. The other is that the federal government serves at the will of the people and should never rise up and rule the people, but is simply there to govern interstate activity, provide for the general welfare, and defend us against enemies, foreign and domestic. That's it. That's all it's supposed to do. Well, you know, and I know, it does 14,000 other things that are not on that list. And we're going to talk about state sovereignty in the last hour of this program. It doesn't apply to all countries, but in a way it does, because even those countries need to declare their sovereignty, whether they're in NATO or whether they're in some other, you know, interstate coalition where they're watching each other's backs because they can't each maintain an army by themselves. You need to declare your sovereignty in these organizations. Yes, you're part of the overall, you know, plan, part of the team, but you're also an individual with your own name on the back of your jersey, with your own team name, with your own internal state regulations. But we've seen time after time after time in recent years, we've seen banking go from state banking to interstate banking to national banking. Now it's global banking. We saw Jim Diamond, CEO of Morgan Stanley, slip up and tell the world that he has $2.3 trillion of depositors' money, cash on hand. I don't know if you know what the ramifications of that are, but that means that there's $2.3 trillion that are not serving the credit needs of those communities. It has been extricated. That money has been exported into one single organization's hands. And what are they doing with that money? Well, you already saw the $2 billion that got lost. They're gambling it. They trade it. They traded from one currency to another currency. They trade in mortgages. They trade in other securities. They trade in paper that has nothing to do with the credit needs of the community. Meanwhile, tens of millions of people starve in our country, and millions of people starve in other countries because there's no cash in the system. It has all been pulled out of the system into the hands of a few global banks. And those banks are doing nothing with it but trading back and forth between themselves to make their executives and make their shareholders wealthy. But they're not taking care of the depositors that built that fortune for them. That's a big problem. In fact, that is the problem. If you go into any town, anywhere, and I said this on Coast to Coast, and I said it on Carrie Cassidy's program the other night, and I'll say it again. Go into any town you want. any country you want, any state you want, any size town or city. And the nicest buildings in town are the banks. And they're building new branches every year. Nice ones. $2-4 million branches. $100 million skyscrapers. The thing to remember is those banks don't earn money. You give them the money. The banks don't make anything. They don't manufacture anything. The only thing they do is take your deposits, charge you interest to get it out, of course, pay you very little interest for you to keep it there. And then as soon as the bank closes every afternoon, that money goes on the money market. It's traded 30, 40, 50 times a month in small little micro trades by computer programs. Yeah, they only make 0.1% here, 0.2% there. But you do it 30 or 40 times a month and it adds up. You make 4 or 5% on the money per month. Per annum, that's 36 to 48% a year on your money. Add to that the fact that you deposited the money in the first place and you increase the yields even more to the bank. Well, the bank should be making so much money that they should turn around and meet the credit needs of their community. But no, there are over 200,000 Small Business Administration loan applications sitting on loan officers' desks all over America. And there could be so many more, except that only 3% of banks even know the programs exist. So with only 3% of the banks even knowing that the program exists, they're not going to get involved in the program. The banks that do know that the programs exist take those loan applications and try to get them underwritten by the federal government, but they can't. And the reason they can't is because the banks will not back the programs. Let's see what Mr. X from North Carolina. Must be local. You're not looking in my window, are you, Mr. X? Welcome to the program.
Looking at your window, looking at your baseball hat. What team is that? No.
I don't have
baseball. The NASCAR?
I don't.
Anyway, I tell you why I'm calling about the Occupy movement. I was the first to be arrested in Asheville, North Carolina with my wife. And I'm an old codger, too, 74 years old, you know. But I just wanted to mention, I know this is a plug or whatever. I don't know how you feel about that, but there's going to be, I don't know if your listeners know that if you feed the pigeons in Philadelphia, you can do that. And if you feed the squirrels, you can do that. But if you feed a human being, you go to jail. People don't know that.
That's interesting.
So there's this caravan that's going across America, and they're going into each of them. They're coming. As a matter of fact, they're in Asheville today, and they'll be leaving tomorrow, and they should be in Philadelphia on the 29th with some 10,000 pounds of food, which they're going to give to the homeless of Philadelphia. So whoever's in Philadelphia, I don't know what route they're taking or anything like that, but you know they can check the Occupy. So what's your take on that, Dr. Agnew?
Well, I can tell you one thing. Having been in radio now for 7 years and having been involved with various large companies that are in the business of building automobiles, we don't really know what makes people excited. I mean, we build a car that we think looks really cool. We put it out on the market, and sometimes it sells, and sometimes it don't. It doesn't. Obviously, when we built the Nissan Altima, I kind of thought it was a plain-looking soap dish. We built almost a five-month inventory. It was over 4 months of inventory of this car. We had them parked all over the city. And when we launched the car, it was a crapshoot. We had about close to $500 million tied up in these cars, $455 million. And the car took off and sold, and we paid off all of the debts of the launch in less than 2 years. It was good. But if those cars had not sold, I think Nissan of America would have been out of business. We don't really know what gets people excited. But I know this much, Mr. X. When people do get excited, it is a very rare and powerful American phenomenon. And so when Occupy America first started, when Occupy Wall Street first started, I thought it was a very noble cause. It was sort of like on the heels of the Tea Party. The Tea Party was like, trying to stay within the lines. And The Occupy Party was mad, I think, because Wall Street was hoarding all the money, and they weren't allowing a business to get hold of that money and be able to hire people and put people back to work. Now, the press, I think, kind of twisted that and said that the Occupy Party was the great unwashed and they were looking for a handout. Not the ones I spoke to. The ones I spoke to were intelligent entrepreneurs. They were hardworking. They were outspoken. And they were fairly well organized. And they were committed to their cause, which is a unique American energy that got this nation started. But when I see a very intelligent, very eloquent Occupy person, and we've played his speech before the city council right here on this program, here in Charlotte, he stood up and said, you know, I urge you not to beat the heads of the Occupy people. We'll stay in our border. We're not going to do anything against Bank of America. We're not going to march down the middle of the street. But when the Democrat convention comes to Charlotte, you're going to have tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, Occupy people come from all over the country to hear. They're going to need a mediating force, locals that know where the proper places are to go, know where the places where they can organize and where they can't organize. If you'll support us in that, we'll help you organize these outside groups that come in. The city council flat refused. And that's when I started wanting to interview Occupy Party people on this program. I have never had one accept the challenge. You're the...
Really? Well, I'll tell you, I want to speak for it because October 1st is when I did my first meeting here in Asheville, and I was moved by it, and I stood there outside the Jubilee Church in Asheville, which is kind of a non-denominational Christian kind of thing, and I was right in there, and I didn't see a single homeless person. Because the first thing, it wasn't directed at that. They were attorneys, they were professors, they were really the high end of the people. However, to defend what's happening is this. One of the biggest blights on this planet is the homeless. I'm 73, I'll be 74 in December, and we had Skid Row in New York. And that was it. And now the homeless, they're out there, and they are part of our society. So when you say, hey, everybody's going to get a chance, those homeless are going to come out. I want to tell you, they're going to come out like the roaches going from day to night. And can you say no to that? It shows the wound of our country. And I think that my wife was threatened with being fired. She works here for Whole Foods kind of thing, you know? Yeah. You know why? You know why she was threatened with fire?
No.
She was talking about the possibility, how come they don't have a union? Just talking about it will get you fired. In my dad's time, there was no way that you wouldn't be in a union. The whole thing is crazy. And I am not a Republican, okay? And I'm not into the conspiratorial heavy-duty stuff, you know? I mean, I know, the Art Bell crowd and the... That whole crowd too, you know. I know that crowd too, but I also know the Alex Jones crowd too. So it's a really sad situation. I see it. I mean, I don't know how many intelligent 73 years old. I mean, people are just so damn dumb out there, you know. And I did a radio show in Asheville myself one time, and anyway, I talk too much. I love that you're doing what you're doing, and I love it. And you know, coast to coast with their 8 million people. That is mainstream, you know. And the unfortunate thing is that we get all the truck drivers and stuff in the middle of the night, but we're going to enlighten them, right?
Well, you know, Coast to Coast is the number five broadcast radio program in the country, which is ahead of Rush Limbaugh. Not bad for coming on at 2 o'clock in the morning on the Eastern Seaboard. But you know, George does a great job, and he has to have a guest every single night. I mean, every night, including Saturday and Sunday, and they do it. You know, Tommy does a great job, and Lisa does a great job, and Stephanie does a great job.
I'll tell you who I began to like. You know, Art, no, I knew Art. I knew Art personally way, 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 way back. But I like this new guy that comes on the weekends with a deep voice.
Yeah.
I forget it. You know why? He's so pure. He's so honest. He's saying, I really don't know a lot about this stuff, but you know what? I know how to ask the question. And I love his approach. It's just so innocent and so direct, you know. Well, I think you're doing a great job. I listen to your program. I trust other people are listening to it. I know they are here in Asheville. And, and you're in Charlotte. You broadcast out of North Carolina, right?
We love Asheville Magazine, and we love Mr. Verrato. He does a great job, and we appreciate the clip he gave us on the front end, and he's going to show up again at the end of the program. And any plug that I can give to Asheville Magazine, they're doing a great job, and they're giving us great exposure in Asheville. Asheville, for those of you that have never visited it, is a very eclectic city on the western side of North Carolina in the mountains. It's gorgeous. It's very artsy. And if you're looking for a place to visit in the South, you should not pass up Asheville, North Carolina.
You know, it's got this reputation. Not that I really don't have a lot for the Chamber of Commerce in this town, but it's the cradle of Christianity. I mean, Billy Graham is here.
Yeah.
It's the lesbian capital of America.
Well,
you know, and it's got more witches, and it's got more rebels, and you know, people fight here. People get together. They hang out. It's like its own little nation. It's almost like Quebec in Canada, you know?
Well, you know, they're not the first ones to really be excited about that. I mean, you guys have a mansion over there that used to be a playground for the rich way back in the 1800s, right? You've got the
we don't want to talk about that in the Occupy movement, do we? Do we? But it is true. It is true. It's the biggest house there. But anyway, I don't really care to plug that about Asheville, because all around Asheville, I mean, come on, give me a break. I mean, Charlotte's okay. You know, Charlotte, but, you know, you're the home of Bank of America. My God, you know.
That's true.
I still maintain an account at Bank of America just so I can do the dastardly deeds. And I go in there, and I really have fun with them. And they don't know what to do. I say, hey, how are you guys taking this whole thing and being attacked? Well, anyway, we did here in Asheville, we did close the Bank of America right across from Pritchard Park, where all the stuff, they did close it. They closed the bank.
I hate to see that, because I think Bank of America, of all the banks, Wells Fargo maybe, but Bank of America is really trying to turn things around. They're really trying to meet the credit needs of their community. And frankly, they've been targeted by the short traders, and they would have been put out. Business. It would have been closed by Citigroup had Buffett not put his $5 billion in. Citigroup went off licking their wounds because they tried to naked short Bank of America stock, and they almost succeeded in putting them out of business. Anytime
there's always
I see
more than one side to a coin, you know, and I, right now, I'm no longer active in the Occupy movement right today, because I know, it's reached a point now where the homeless were thrown out, things down, and it's not getting the press anymore, and most of the, it seems to have lost its bite right now, but I do support that what's happening. I do support the food going over to Philadelphia, because I'm originally from Philadelphia, and I think that's a noble gesture, and if somebody wants to find out about it, find out where did we go to, Occupy Asheville or Occupy WallStreet.com, or Occupy Philadelphia, I guess, and find out where that caravan's going. I mean, you know, all the hippies can have a great time.
Got to go where the cameras are. I mean, when Occupy Movement first started out, it was Occupy Wall Street. And, I mean, come on, it doesn't take anybody with half a brain and one eye to figure out Wall Street is doing phenomenal, and Main Street is dying. What's wrong with this picture? It's because the banks are playing games with the stock, with gold, and with cash. And they're not letting mainstream touch that money. That's why Main Street is dying.
Dr. Tegner, what do I do about my gold? Now, here's the situation. I'm watching here in western North Carolina, the gas is down. We have one of the least expensive. It's 32 cents, 32.9 a gallon. Now, has the gas prices dropped? I bought a whole lot of gold. I bought like $40,000 worth of gold, and I got it safely in physical form, you know. I've lost $300, no, about $240 per coin. What
you
the hell's going on with it?
You haven't lost anything. The gold never changes value. It's the dollar that changes value. Gold will buy the same today as it did in 1800. It never changes value. It's the dollars that change value. That's why I don't invest in gold. It's worthless. to me, because it never changes value. It's a terrible investment. It's only a hedge against inflation.
Why did I call you before now? What do I do? You come visit me?
Hold on to it, and you'll see. Gas is down to like $80, or oil's down to $80 a barrel now. But I can tell you right now that Russia cannot make money at $80 a barrel. It has to be at $100 a barrel, or Russia is losing money. If once you see oil drop below $100, you will see the Russian military on the move. They're going to be acquiring more oil properties. They're going to be going for warm weather ports, and they're going to be messing with the governments of other countries. And that's exactly what you're seeing. Oil has $100 a barrel.
My wife is from Russia. What you're saying is so true. I know. I know the head of the mafia in Moscow.
Oil has to be maintained above $100 a barrel because we're using it as an economic weapon against China. It has to be held above $100 a barrel.
All right. When do I sell my gold?
At the highest possible point, I suppose, or change it into some other form that...
Land. Do you think land is land a good thing?
Land right now is not for sale. It is being stolen. Literally, if I could tell you the number of skyscrapers that have sold for literally 2 to 5 cents on the dollar, they're being scooped up by the billions every single month by investors.
So that's a good thing to buy land then, what you're saying.
Is exactly. After the Depression in 1931, 32, 33, people with cash were moving in and buying up whole city blocks. That's exactly the same thing that you're seeing happen right now. The Rock Group out of Salt Lake City owns $10 billion worth of buildings that they've bought in the last 5 years alone.
Did you hear that? Yeah, well, if you own a house, it's bad, but if you don't have it and you have money,
not a house.
Maybe I'll do that gold and see if I can leverage it somewhere, somehow.
Not a house. I'm talking about commercial property, skyscrapers, apartments, hotels, malls, this kind of scooped up for 10 cents on the dollar if you have cash.
Well, bless you. Bless you. Good hearing you on the radio. Good hearing you. If you ever get to Asheville, just look up Mr. X, okay?
Yeah, I will be. Thank you so much for coming.
Bless you. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, let's take a quick break. That segment ran a little bit long, but we will do that when we have great callers on, like Mr. X from North Carolina. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
All the knights in armor come saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned-up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
in a dream, all in a dream. The loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Sorry, I cut that piece about 5 seconds short. That's the Alice Band singing Neil Young's song After the Gold Rush. Thank you for being here on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains, an undisclosed location. Our AccuWinder forecast, 76 degrees. Skies are clearing up, but it's going to rain tomorrow. Then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it's going to be bright and sunny. Great days for riding, which I am not doing because on May 3rd, I got run over on my motorcycle and I'm convalescing pretty well. I actually got my cast off and I'm speaking tonight without my neck brace. I hope you can tell. If you want to be part of the program tonight, and I encourage you to do so, it's 888-429-5471. You're important to me. You're important to society. Your voice, your thoughts will go out globally for everyone in the world to hear. You don't have to give us your name. You heard Mr. X from North Carolina coming in on the last hour, and that's fine. You want to call yourself Mr. Z or Miss Y, that's fine. If you want to step out and still listen to X Squared Radio Live, there are two ways that you can do it. One, you can call our conference line, which is 760-569-7676. Then dial the passcode 192-919-pound, and you can listen to the program. You won't be able to interact, but you'll be able to listen. The other way is that you can go to xsquaredradio.com, and you can click on the Droid app. I wrote a Droid app. So you click on the app on the left-hand side of the website, download the app to your phone, and all you have to do is punch that app, and you will be instantly into Channel 2 on BBS Radio. Of course, you can listen to other hosts on Channel 2 if you want to, no problem, throughout the week. But every Sunday evening from 5 to 8 Pacific time, 8 to 11 Eastern time, you can click on that app and listen to us live here on X Squared Radio. And I'm going to improve that app. I'm getting better at it as I go. I'm going to improve that app. But once you're in the app and listening to the program, if you feel so inspired that you want to ask a question, you just press the button on the side of the app, and it will dial up the studio in Paradise, California, and you'll be in to us here at X Squared Radio, and you can ask the question. I don't have it going yet, but I'm working on it. And I don't have the iPad app yet going because I haven't figured it out yet. I've got the developer code. I paid my $99. I've gotten all the tech help that I can, and I still can't make the app work. So if there's somebody out there that knows how to make iPad or iPhone or iPod apps go, if you would get a hold of me and corroborate with me, I think it would be cool because we have a lot of Mac users out there, different kinds of Apple products that want to listen to the program live using their various smart stuff and listen to the program. So just an open call out there if anybody's willing to do it. As you are making your plans for this fall, there are three conferences I want you to pay attention to. One, of course, is the one that's at Trout Lake, Washington, starting on the 29th. I'll be up there on the evening of the 28th through the 3rd of July. And that is up at James Gilliland's ranch in Trout Lake, Washington. I actually did not have it on my schedule to go this year. I had lots and lots of stuff to do with the car company. But James called me a couple days ago and said, hey, we have an opening. We'd like to have you up here. And, of course, I dropped everything that was important in my life and changed my priorities because I know where my priorities are while I'm on this planet. And that's where yours should be, too. So we need a couple hundred more people to sign up for that. It, for the money, is the best conference in the country. If you've never seen a UFO, well, don't worry. Because if you go to that conference and you leave without seeing a bona fide UFO experience, you were sleeping the whole time. I've never been up there, but what I haven't seen, some very strange, unidentified flying object. And most years I photograph one. So it's definitely worth going. I'll be talking about my new book, Alienated Nation, up there. This is the first presentation I've made about the book, so this will be a world debut. The second one that I want you to pay close attention to is the Pythagoras Conference, put on by Sandra Sabatini, myself, and others. And all you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the blue banner on the right-hand side that says Pythagoras Conference. You'll get $100 off, which is a great value. You don't have to fly. You don't have to have a passport. You don't have to rent a car. You simply drive to southern Indiana. It's within a six-hour drive of over half the country. And I got to tell you, we never have conferences of this caliber and this size in the Midwest. If you want to go to something like this, you have to drive to California. You got to fly to California. You got to go to San Jose. Got to go to L.A. Got to go to Burbank. Got to go to Sacramento. Even Shasta. But you never, ever hear about conferences of this caliber and this quality and this size in the Midwest. It's an awesome opportunity. It's going to be at a resort in southern Indiana. It's easy to get to from everywhere. I-64, I-75, everything links up in this area. You can get there. 50 of the top speakers from around the world are going to be there, including myself. I might be 49th, but I think you'll have a great time, and it's affordable. The next conference is the granddaddy of them all. It is the once-in-a-lifetime conference, maybe even more than that, a once-in-a-millennia conference, December 21st, 2012, the date everyone has been talking about for a long, long time. We wrote over 2,000 pages about this event, and we've been invited to speak with Power Places, with Greg Braden and Maureen St. Germain and other key speakers from around the world. We're meeting at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. We're leaving on the 13th of December. We'll have everybody back by the 22nd of December. I promise to have you home by Christmas. Join me down there at Ground Zero when the Mayan calendar clicks over to zero. You'll have some stories to tell your kids and your grandkids when people ask you, where did you spend December 21st, 2012? You can tell them, I was there. I was at Ground Zero at the temple in Chichen Itza. Join me, Maya 2012. Click the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com and get signed up. I promise you will not be disappointed. Our phone number tonight, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Call in tonight. We'll talk about any subject you want, although we have some great subjects coming up. Tonight we were supposed to have Amit Goswami, so those of you that saw the BBS Radio headliner, he was scheduled to come on tonight. He is traveling tonight. He is older than time itself. And we love to have him on the program, but sometimes when you're traveling, you just don't have it in you to do an interview on the road. And that's fine with us. We'll schedule him another time. We will have him on. He wrote a fantastic book called God Is Not Dead. The title belies what's inside, because we're going to take downward causation and the possibilities of quantum consciousness to a whole nother level. Amit Goswami. So we understand. Sometimes I have to call in an archive too. Now, I know you're wondering what's going on in Chile's desert. You probably were just thinking about that this week. I know. People think about it all the time. But there are some never-before-seen microbes that have been found in Chile's desert. You didn't even know Chile had a desert. You thought Chile, we're talking about mountains, right? Earthquakes, volcanoes, tropical rainforests, and all that. Uh-uh. In the Atacama Desert, it looks so much like Mars, it blows your mind. Chile's Atacama Desert, a team led by University of Colorado Boulder, has found extremely rare life on the soil at the top of two volcanoes in Chile's Atacama Desert. Results from the 2009 expedition released last week said unique microbes were discovered that may be linked to research on Mars. Team member Ryan Lynch, a doctoral student at CU Boulder, explained the significance of this discovery to the Santiago Times in an interview Wednesday. He says, Mars is pretty different from Earth, but one of the things this research could do is help us understand and find the limit to life here, how Mars could be favorable to life. The driest desert on Earth, the Atacama, is one of the most uninhabitable environments on the Earth. The desert spans 600 miles and is located from Peru's southern border into northern Chile. During winter, temperatures can go as high as 79 degrees Fahrenheit, but as low as 45 degrees Fahrenheit. The microbes were discovered at around 6,000 meters elevation. That's about 19,000 feet. I've been that high in the Himalayas. It is uninhabitable. There is not so much as a green leafy lichen on the ground. The wind blows constantly. It's hard to breathe. You don't want to spend much time there because you get cataracts. But it takes a while to acclimate yourself to get up that high. We were scheduled to go to 23,500 feet, but four of our 11-person team got altitude sickness, and that was as high as we were going. So fortunately, we had a wonderful American-made Cummins diesel in our bus, and we were able to negotiate 18,500 feet without any issue. So 6,000 meters is way up there. My empathy goes out to grad student Ryan Lynch up there doing this study. But he's on Volcan Lulailaco and Volcan Sacompa. The thin atmosphere and high radiation in the volcanoes makes them some of the most similar places on Earth to Mars. CU Boulder professor Steve Schmidt, who led the expedition, probably had several grad students going with them that were working on their PhDs, is also working with astrobiologists to model what past conditions were like on Mars. What is most interesting to the researchers is the non-complexity of the new organisms. The researchers say they are capable of converting energy in a completely different way compared to known species. But these are very different than anything else that has ever been cultured, Lynch said. Genetically, they're at least 5% different than anything else in the DNA database of 2.5 million sequences. I don't know if you know this, but 5% is a huge amount of difference in DNA. On our planet, all the species that we have studied are within that group of 5%. Everything from cabbage to shrimp to humans fits in that 5%. The DNA is a pretty narrow band. So to have something at least 5% different than anything else in the DNA database of 2.5 million sequences makes this definitely a foreigner, not from our neighborhood. The bacteria discovered have not yet been identified as scientists continue to examine the organisms. The process of identifying microbes is a long one, but our next steps are to grow them in labs and test them, Lynch told the Santiago Times. We're making progress sequencing genes. Well, I hope very much, because I know how these things go as students come in and then go out. I hope very much that Dr. Steve Schmidt make sure that these bacteria do not get mislabeled once they're brought back to Colorado. I hope they don't make it into the wastewater. I hope they don't make it into growing conditions that are a lot more conducive to the bacteria, and I hope they're not virulent. So if they can survive up there, they can survive just about anywhere, and maybe they might flourish. You never know what you might what might be confiscated and weaponized. So that would be something for which there would be no immunity, especially if it were 5% different than any other DNA sequenced on our planet. Not something we really want to get ourselves into, I think. But that's just a little civilian oversight mindset that I'm talking about. I don't know if you know much about CU Boulder, but they do have a lot of military research that goes on there. Most universities do, but that one more than most. Boulder is also the location near Golden, Colorado, which is the head of the National Renewable Energy Lab, where they're doing a lot of algae for biodiesel and jet fuel research. And you know that that is aggressively being, at least on the reactor side, being researched. Some people say that they can grow bacteria in reactors, and you can. Done it before, seen it done. The problem is that the bacteria or the algae gets sick. The algae forms a nice, sweet, yummy, warm culture, and the bacteria get in it and eat it up. And I think you know what, well, maybe you don't know what bacteria smell or algae smells like when it gets sick with bacteria, but let me just run it by you. Take a tractor trailer load of fresh fish and dump it into the middle of the hot San Diego freeway and let it sit for 3 weeks. That's what algae smells like when it gets sick. Yeah, it's a terrible smell. Brown, nasty, fermenting, horrible smell. And that's what happens to biodiesel algae for biodiesel reactors when they get sick. Maybe someday, of course, I made a presentation to the very same group for a part of a DOE grant years ago, and they rejected it, of course, because I'm not a billion-dollar multinational corporation. But we've already been through that and know how to solve that problem. But not interested. That's okay. It'll stay in my files until somebody's interested in it. Lots more going on and lots of great news this hour to get yourself empowered, get yourself informed, awakened, so that you can position yourself in the right place. By the way, thank you very much for the listeners in Slovenia right now. They're listening and sending in ideas. They've made an inquiry to me about the Venus Project, and I'm not really familiar with what the Venus Project is, but I'm going to research it. I'll find an expert on it, see if they want to come and interview about it. I am a student of economic science. Any kind of science fascinates me, even political science. Although we do talk about governmental issues here, we try to shy away from one side of the aisle or the other side of the aisle, because those are just games. Those are just reality show games that are played before the TV. That's not really what goes on in Washington. It's a bunch of silliness. But if you're talking about economic science or political science, you've come to the right place. We'll do that here. We're not so much into the conspiracy theories unless you have conspiracy facts. 888-429-5471. Here we go. Next subject. House bill extends the TSA, that's the Traffic Safety Administration. It's one of those, yes. It's a subgroup of the Homeland Security Group, but it is also an agency, okay, the Traffic Safety Administration. It's one of the agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus. Anyway, they are now intel sharing to mass transit and not just aircraft. We have been seeing them in our airports for a number of years. Have we ever gotten used to them? Have you? Hold on one moment. Lovely grapefruit juice. I fly a fair amount. Some of you may not. The ones that do fly a fair amount, it's an inconvenience, to say the least. Before 9/11, you used to be able to see your loved ones off at the gate. You used to be able to greet your loved ones as they landed inside the airport. Americans enjoyed their airports. And yes, we had a plane hijacked from time to time. It would get hijacked at Cuba or something like that. But there weren't sweeping actions to shut down all the airports and turn them over to some, you know, federal agency. The airports managed to control their own security. Each airport, each state did a good job of controlling the airspace behind that Part 135 and Part 121 fence. Part 135 is charter flights and Part 121 is scheduled flights, just so that you know, FAR, Part 121. The states and the airports did a good job, airlines, of controlling that. But after 9/11, things changed. The federal government stepped in, the Patriot Act was sweeping reform, and the formation of the Homeland Security Department, which is headed up by a presidential appointee. So it is a complete agency that is run by the executive branch. This year, it has an official $89 billion budget. I know, because I printed the budget out for myself and read it. And over 50%, I think 58% of the budget is at the discretion of the secretary. The secretary appears in the budget so many times, I don't even want to number it. I haven't done a lexicon search of it, but it's unbelievable how much discretion the secretary has. The secretary is an appointee by the president, and we've already seen how the president appoints his secretaries. Normally, the appointees like that are through the advice and consent of the Senate. However, our current administration has appointed at least two and maybe more, well, at least two secretaries and many more czars. Isn't czar a Russian word or Soviet word? Something. Maybe it's a Bolshevik word. Does anybody know, my friends in Slovenia, do you know the origin of the word czar? C-Z-A-R. That's not an American word. Anyway, the president, the administration has appointed czars, dozens of them. They work not at the head of the organization, but right at the head of certain actions that take place inside these organizations. For instance, we've had car czars that were responsible for liquidating billions and billions of dollars worth of assets of the car companies to restructure them. Yes, of course. It's to be expected that all of the assets that ended up on the upside, that is the metal side up and the rubber side down, were Democrat supporters and presidential contributors, yes. But that could just be coincidence. Well, maybe. I mean, out of the more than 790 closures, all but two of them were contributors to the administration. One of the two that was a contributor was one of two that happened to be in the same city, but the other one was a stronger supporter of the administration, and so it ended up with the only Chrysler dealership in that city. The other one, the lesser one, was closed. So Chrysler was completely reorganized by a czar who immediately afterwards was indicted for fraud. So just to let you know how nefarious this gets, how deep and dark and fascist this gets. So one of those organizations is the Homeland Security Department, and one of those administrations under that is the Transportation Security Administration. It already shares intelligence it collects with airports. Now a House bill would expand TSA's intel sharing to local mass transit systems as well. Representative Jackie Speier, Democrat from California, the bill's sponsor, said the legislation is a common sense approach to fighting terrorism. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Might as well be fighting jealousy. Might as well be fighting, you know, rage or fighting anger or fighting what? Frustration, terrorism. That's such a movable target. That's like the most movable target I can think of. Anyway, it's a convertible target. It's terrorism. The House passed the bill May 30th, and the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs is now considering the bill, just so you know. So if you know a senator, or you know their phone number, or you know their email address, or you know how to put their name into Google to get those items, you could write them. And you could say, we don't want to expand the Transportation Security Administration's budget. We don't want to expand the Transportation Security Administration's purview. We don't want the Transportation Security Administration to share intel to local mass transit systems. We don't want those kinds of searches going on our buses, on our trains, on our subways, on our high-speed rails, on our light trains. We don't want that. We enjoy our freedoms as Americans. We enjoy our ability to travel freely without having to show our papers while moving around the country. If you want to fight terrorism, then fight terrorism. We know what they sound like. We know what they look like. We know what their religious beliefs are. Concentrate your efforts and stop searching me and my friends and my grandmothers and my aunts and my toddlers. Stop searching them. In an interview with the Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Emily Kopp, Spire said the bill creates fusion centers where the TSA can provide intel to local law enforcement and emergency management officials. We have put in place, through TSA, a very elaborate system in airports. We all go through those metal detectors and those secondary searches. You know, the secondary searches. The ones with the little blue smooth gloves. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Put your arms out at your side, lean your head back, and relinquish your privacy to me. And we've put a lot of focus on the airlines for good reason. But we have neglected the mass transit components. Oh, it's true. It's true. I mean, come on. How many times have terrorists hijacked a subway? How many times have they hijacked a bus? How many times have they threatened violence on a monorail or a high-speed light rail in town? Well, but it could happen. Maybe it could happen. Well, don't you think that 300 million Americans might have something to say about that? Because I can tell you this, my friends. Anybody stands up on an airplane that I'm on and says, I'm taking this baby down, they're not going to get the word down out of their mouth. They're going to be face down in the middle of that aisle with 10 passengers right in the middle of their back. Their hands will be behind their back, and it'd be over that quick. And if it's not, if they stand up and they should happen to have a weapon on them, it's no problem. The pilot dumps the air out of the cabin. The little oxygen masks pop down. You put one on as a passenger. If you don't have one on, within 2 minutes, you're unconscious. Within 5 minutes, you're dead. If you're not in your seat with a mask on, in 2 minutes, you're unconscious. In 5 minutes, you're dead. Simple as that. And nobody, but nobody, is getting through that cockpit door. Problem solved. You don't need to keep your mothers, your daughters, your sons, your grandkids away from that gate. We want our airports back. We don't want to go through that mess and that invasion in our subways, in our bus stations, in our train stations. Spire said 2 million people fly each day, compared with more than 5 million who ride the subway each day in New York City alone. She pointed, and by the way, 5 million people have been riding the subway each day in New York for 100 years without an incident. 100 years without an incident. She pointed out that the most recent terrorist attacks have been on mass transit, not in this country. Also, when U.S. Special Forces raided Osama bin Laden's compound last year, intelligence gathered revealed the next attack was intended for mass transit. Uh-huh. So you raided an old man's house in Pakistan, shot him in the face while he was wearing his pajamas. You had the most valuable intel target since Adolf Hitler standing in front of you in his pajamas. You were armed and armored, and you couldn't bag and tag this guy and put him in a helicopter and fly him home for investigation and for intelligence gathering. You had to shoot him in the cheekbone and dump him in the water. What's wrong with this picture, folks? What is wrong with this picture? That SEAL Team 6 could not bag this guy, put him in a helicopter, and fly him out. They could have drugged him, but they didn't. It raises two questions, doesn't it, when we're talking about Osama bin Laden? Was he there at all? Did he die a decade ago, and it just became inconvenient to keep it a secret any longer? Or was he the most valuable CIA operative we ever had? And if he opened his mouth the wrong way, it would have implicated people in high places. So he's better off dead. Those are just my questions. I'm sure you can come up with more. 888-429-5471. I'm sure those questions crossed your mind. I'm just asking them. Maybe you have the answers. Spire says, the writing is on the wall. We need to be better prepared than we are right now. Mr. Spire, I don't get it. What wall? I mean, Ms. Spire. Which wall are you talking about? Are you talking about the subway walls? The writing is on the subway walls that we need to be better prepared than we are right now? The writing was on the bathroom wall of Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan? Is that what you're talking about? Transit riders probably won't see more TSA agents in subways or bus stops, though, Spire said. The expanded TSA role falls more on analysts. Forgot to put one sentence in there, whoever wrote this article. For now. Once the camel gets its nose in the tent, before long, you got fleas. Just interesting stuff. Just so you know, it isn't going to stop there. Articles by Jolly Lee. And it's a good article. Representative Jackie Spire, Democrat, California, is the source of the information. We pray, we hope that you call your senators and say, no more TSA in our organizations. You want to do this, do it from a distance. But the subways have been operating for 100 years in this country with no incidents at all. We've had a mugging every now and then. We've had a little vigilante activity. We've had a little voyeurism. We've had a little, you know, crazy stuff going on, but no terrorism. If you ask me, there's enough terrorism going on with the blue shirts that are operating in that area. So let's change gears just a little bit. Let's talk about asteroids. You know, when Elenin showed up on the radar screen, well, so to speak, some people were predicting that it was going to come painfully close to Earth. They asked me to do some research on it, which I did, and I'm not a great comet researcher. But I gathered as much as I could, and what I could tell is that Elenin was, in fact, a comet. A little weird-shaped, yes. Some questions about its trajectory and its origin, yes. Didn't come out of the normal Oort cloud that we normally see, but it looked like a comet, it acted like a comet, and it was behaving like a comet, and the jury was still out until it got close enough to the sun. What I said is that when Elenin gets close enough to the sun, it should start off-gassing, When it does, comets have loosely collected heads, which look like they're corporeal from a distance. They look rather structured from a distance, but they're not really dense. They don't have a lot of gravity. They're just held together barely by, you know, hydrogen bonding, if that. And when they get close enough to the sun, they start off-gassing violently, like a steam explosion, dumping, you know, thousands and thousands of tons of material as it boils off every second. And when that happens, it normally blows the head apart. And if that doesn't, as it passes the gravitational field of large planets like Jupiter or others, the Roche limit kicks in. And what happens is the gravitational field of the larger body overcomes the very tenuous gravitational pull of the cometary head, and the head falls apart. And when it does, it usually falls into, I don't know, a dozen, half a dozen parts, and it goes flying off toward, you know, the next gravitational field and disappears, as we saw Shoemaker-Levy do the same thing. Jupiter just vacuumed it right out of space for us. This one was a little bit too far away for Jupiter to pick up, but nevertheless, time would tell, and sure enough, Elenin got close enough to the sun. It started off-gassing, and it didn't pass within a couple hundred thousand miles of Earth. Disappeared like a fart in a whirlwind. But the good news is that it alerted people, because there were a couple things that and a couple of subsequent asteroids from there did to kind of get us ready. Ready in the sense that, you know what, we've looked around and maybe we're not ready for an asteroid or a comet to enter our neighborhood. So for the last 3 years, near-Earth object alert teams have been meeting in Pasadena near JPL. And they've been considering, you know, what to do. How do we deal with something that just pops up on the radar screen? It's not a perennial. We don't see it every year. It doesn't make an orbit. It's a new player, something that got bumped or pulled or spit or shoved out of orbit, you know, by accident, by some random event is now coming our way. And we've had them come close, folks. I mean, within, you know, inside the orbit of our own GPS satellites. They're out 23,500 miles. Some of these asteroids the size of a city bus have come through at 14,000 miles. Now, that's a near miss. That's a statistically in the backyard. Is it a real threat to Earth? No. But it is enough to get us to think about what would we do if there was something the size of Rhode Island headed our way. It doesn't even have to be that big. If it were dense, and usually these asteroids are, they're iron or nickel or something quite dense that can make it through our atmosphere in one piece. If it doesn't skip off the atmosphere like we see fireballs do from time to time, although usually those are about the size of your fist or a Volkswagen, but something the size of a city bus or a rail car, if it was solid metal, could make it through our atmosphere. And if it was at the right trajectory, right angle, it could make it through the atmosphere and it could strike the planet. Now, if it strikes dry ground, that's, of course, going to be devastating. It's going to dump a bunch of dust up in the air. It's probably going to be responsible for lowering the temperature of the planet, maybe a degree, maybe more. It's going to be cataclysmic. Is it going to be life-ending? No. But it's still going to be a major inconvenience, especially if it lands anywhere close to anything populated, which it probably would if it landed on dry land. It would be even worse by a factor of 10 or maybe a factor of 50 if it landed in water. Because if it landed in the ocean, it would not only eject a whole bunch of water vapor high up into the atmosphere, which is not sterile. That is to say, it's not distilled water. It's not evaporated water vapor that coagulates up in the air. And when temperature and humidity reach the dew point, it falls into clouds and falls back to Earth. This is seawater dumped up into the atmosphere whole, like a giant geyser. And when it's up there, 50, 60,000 feet, it's going to start circling the globe. And it's going to mix with rainwater. And when salt water starts raining on your crops, it doesn't ruin your day. It ruins your decade. Okay, that's one problem. The other problem is that it makes a big splash. And you know what happens when a big splash happens in a pond, right? The waves go out in every direction. If an asteroid that size strikes the ocean at Mach 7 or Mach 10, it is going to make a tsunami 1,000 feet high, traveling at hundreds of miles an hour in every direction. And when it gets into shallow water, it's going to rise up out of the water 300, 400 meters, and it's going to hit land. And when it does, it's going to go inland 20 to 50 miles, depending on the elevation. And you think the one in Indonesia was bad, that little 30-footer? Nothing. Nothing in comparison. 90% of the population lives within 20 miles of a coast. That includes the major rivers, but it holds true. If it strikes the eastern seaboard of any country, the western seaboard of any country, it is going to be devastating. You're talking half the population of that country disappearing in a matter of minutes. And all the roads, and all the buildings, all the factories, all the assets, all the investment, not billions, tens of trillions of dollars of investment, wiped to a sandbar in one day. So it makes sense to have some preparation, some kind of team, somewhere on the planet, in the atolls, some equatorial or some polar region, some kind of missile system, some kind of, you know, stick a rocket engine to it and take it off course plan. I mean, there's a dozen different ideas being tossed out there by people that have do nothing but sit around and think about this, which we don't on this program. I'm just raising the question. But the question was put out there by Space Magazine. 2,429 people voted. Now, admittedly, this is a niche. These are people that have computers. These are people that have internet access. And these are people who read Space Magazine. I'm one of them. Here is how the votes laid out. The question was, what do you think about Earth being prepared to deal with an asteroid or a comet? 73.65% of people who read Science Magazine, who have computers and who access the internet, smarter than the average bears, I think, believe that we are sitting ducks for an asteroid. 13.22% are not sure. So if you lump those two together, and I do because I'm a statistician and I like to deal with absolutes, that means that 86.87% of the people surveyed out of 2,429 votes, admittedly a niche, but a scientific niche to say the least, believe we are at least not sure or sure that we are sitting ducks. The only ones that count in the other direction are the people that are absolutely sure, 100%, that scientists have things under control. Guess what? 13.13%. That's it. That's it. Less, around 1 out of 8 people thinks the scientists have everything under control. I know. NASA says, no, we don't have anything. JPL, nope, sorry, nothing to deal with asteroids, not anything like that. Air Force, Navy, nope, not from us. We have no plans. These 13% are sure somewhere in the background there's a black project that's there to deal with that city bus-sized chunk of iron and nickel that's headed at 18 to 40,000 miles an hour toward Earth. What do you think? 888-429-5471. What do you think? Do you think the planet's ready to deal with that? Do you think that if another Elenin showed up and it wasn't an asteroid, that it was going to show up on a collision course with Earth? Let's just say on the outside, we're really good, we're really lucky. Some amateur is running discretionary digital photography out there with a 12-inch Schmidt Cassegrain scope, and they happen to be looking at the right 2-degree swath of space. And they happen to find that one dot that keeps moving across the screen, and it ain't a planet. and it's headed our way, and they make that call, hey, I'm John Doe, and I'm located in the Rocky Mountains. I'm located in Canada. I'm located in the southern tip of Mexico, and I've seen this dot. The Doe asteroid is on its way to Earth, and it's going to be here in 3 months. Are we ready? 888-429-5471. Now, admittedly, the odds are 1,000,000 to 1, maybe 50 million to 1, maybe 50 billion to 1, because Earth is a little teeny tiny blue dot 3 months away. That's as far away as Mars. It's just a little blue dot. But if we have meteorites on the polar ice from Mars and from the moon and from various moons around our solar system that are sprinkled out over the sand or sprinkled out over the ice, and we have meteor hunters all over this country that are going out hunting for meteorites and mapping them every single day, and there's no small amount. There are hundreds of thousands of these things being found all over the country. Ever wonder how the Carolina Lakes got formed? That's right. They got formed by asteroids. They go across North and South Carolina. That same iron deposit goes all the way across the Atlantic and on up into the Siberian desert. That's a heck of a splatter field. Earth has been hit before. There are ancient tree forests that are laid flat underneath the silt of the lakes across North and South Carolina. It's happened before. It can happen again. Are we ready? 87% of Science magazine readers say they have their doubts or they're sure. We're sitting ducks. What do you think? 888-429-5471. More space news. You know, we talk about the Big Bang from time to time in my book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. I have a chapter claiming that the Big Bang never happened. And this is a perspective, because if you look at the universe from the point of view of a photon, which every photon does as it leaves whatever star generates it out there, it heads out across the vast expanse of space, and somehow it makes it to Earth, and we get to see it in our eyes or in our telescopes or in our radio telescopes. We pick up these frequencies, these photons in some frequency of light, whether it's visible or non-visible, infrared, X-ray, etc. The point is that once that photon leaves that point of origin, it's traveling at the speed of light. And as my good friend Dr. Ed Close in his book Transcendental Physics claims, correctly I think, is that at the speed of light, the distance of space shrinks to nothing. Because time, in the true physics sense, is a distance. We don't think about, you know, billions of miles between stars. We think of light years. You know, the distance that something travels at the speed of light. But at the speed of light, we also know what time does. We know that time becomes asymptotic, and at the speed of light becomes zero, which means that the entire universe is local to the photon. And when asked, every metaphysicist and most physicists and most ordinary people who are neither, what the speed of thought is, they almost unanimously agree that the speed of thought is the fastest thing in the universe, many times the speed of light, that the entanglement of consciousness across the expanse of this planet and maybe others instantaneously connects two minds together, two thoughts together, across time, across space, across lifetimes. Many times the speed of light. It means that time can actually go backwards. It means that thought can actually be omniscient. That is to say, omnipresent, omni-aware of all things at all times. Now, we're not, as humans, because we choose not to be. Otherwise, we wouldn't be human. The eternal being inside the human body, inside the biological transducer, which I call the human body, or the human body, which I call the biological transducer, limits our eternal body. It limits our eternal being. And I guess by design, because when we think about what hell would be, if you think about it, some people do, hell is really nothing more than nothing new. Everything is known. And it's like having a bowl full of the best chocolate chip cookies in the entire world and a refrigerator full of empty milk cartons. It's like sitting at a table and chair, you know, smoking your favorite cigarette or whatever, or looking out over the beach or the mountains or clouds or whatever, forever, never moving, no challenge, nothing new. That sounds like hell to me. I want something new. I want a change of space. I want greener grass. I want a challenge. I want a hurdle. I want a stopwatch. I want to challenge myself. I want a test. I want an exam. I want to learn something. If you know everything, you can't learn anything. If you're not learning, you're not growing, you're not challenging, you're not leaping, you're not flying, you're not competing against yourself, against life, against survival, we are not satisfied as beings. We have been competing against everything, including nature, since the beginning of mortal life, all mortal life. It is the nature of the spirit inside of us. So, the question comes up, how did the Big Bang occur? Scientists believe the Big Bang could have popped into existence with no help from God. It's true. That's what they think. That's what they are speculating right now. I want to talk about it. I want you to call in about it, and we're going to discuss it. Right after this, let's listen to a little Civil Twilight while I drink my grapefruit juice, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
These are only walls to hold me.
All right, welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad you're here with us today. I'm your host, Brooks Agner. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our IQ window forecast, 72 degrees. Very humid outside. The humidity is around 125%, off and on rain, trying to evaporate and trying to fall from the sky at the same time. It's going to be that way tomorrow, too, so not a good bike riding day. But Tuesday through Friday should be amazing, amazing. Thursday, we're headed up to Washington State to be at James Gilliland's Trout Lake Retreat, his sanctuary. And we're going to do some stargazing out there and some spirit drumming and all kinds of cool stuff. So it should be a tremendous amount of fun. By the way, the word czar from my friends in Slovenia comes from the word T-Z-A-R, and it's mentioned all the way back to 1555. I'm sure the meaning is not good. Some kind of self-proclaimed leader with divine right, and we all know where that goes. Anyway, we're talking about the Big Bang in the last hour, and I want you to be part of the conversation. So our phone line's 888-429-5471. Outside the country, you're going to have to go to xsquaredradio.com or bbsradio.com, and you're going to have to look at the non-toll-free numbers for getting into the program. You can reach us through Skype, and we have people doing that right now. By the way, the literal translation of the word czar means ruler. Ruler. So it's exactly what I was talking about in the first hour, that government, the federal government, has stopped governing the country, and it is now ruling the country. How do you feel about that? I would love to hear your thoughts. 888-429-5471. You can Skype, text them to me, or you can call in the program at that toll-free number I just gave you, and we can talk about it. I'm sure there's some passion out there on this. Otherwise, we would not be maxing out the servers right now, just like we are. So science says the Big Bang could have popped into existence with no help from God. Our universe could have popped into existence 13.7 billion years ago without any divine help whatsoever, researchers say. Doesn't mean that it did. They're just saying that it could have. That may run counter to our instincts, which recoil at the thought of something coming from nothing. But we shouldn't necessarily trust our instincts, for they were honed to help us survive on the African savanna 150,000 years ago, not understand the inner workings of the universe. Okay, whatever this article writer would like to say. The Big Bang could have occurred as a result of just the laws of physics being there, said astrophysicist Alex Filipenko of the University of California, Berkeley. With the laws of physics, you can get universes. Well, that's true. You can. Filipenko told, spoke Saturday, that would be June 23rd, yesterday, at the SETICON 2 conference during a panel discussion called Did the Big Bang Require a Divine Spark? Well, there are a couple theories out there. Most of them rely on what we call Higgs events, H-I-G-G-S. The best way for me to describe a Higgs event to you is like this. It is a random tension that's left behind as something compresses, sort of like balling up a ball of Velcro. You know, if you try to crunch up a ball of Velcro very, very small, the little loops and the little hooks kind of catch on each other, right? So as you're crunching it smaller and smaller and smaller, some of the tension really builds between the hooks and the loops, and eventually one snaps. And in the sense of all this matter being smashed into the smallest possible place, and I use the word possible from a Heisenberg uncertainty point of view, obviously the more matter that's crunched into that space, the more uncertain the location of the singularity becomes, and the event horizon gets larger and larger and larger and larger. Now, obviously, if you have a universe, according to the Big Bang theory, all smashed into one singularity, the Heisenberg uncertainty becomes almost incalculable. calculable, but it would take one heck of a computer to determine the location and velocity of the singularity. The point is that there are some quantum fluctuations in this, a lot like the Casimir effect, only on a big, big scale. In the very weird world of quantum mechanics, which describes action on a subatomic scale, random fluctuations can produce matter and energy out of nothingness. We do see that, but it's also very, very small amounts of matter. And this can lead to very big things indeed, but it takes resonance. Quantum mechanical fluctuations can produce the cosmos, said panelist Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer at the nonprofit Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, that's SETI. If you would just, in this room, just twist time and space the right way, you might create an entirely new universe. Well, that's what they do in Washington all the time. They twist space and time the right way to create their own universe, where they are famous and they are intelligent. Well, anyway, it's not clear you could get into that universe, but you could create it. So, it could be that this universe is merely the science fair project of a kid in another universe, Shostak added. I don't know how that affects your theological leanings, but it is something to consider. Filipenko stressed that such statements are not attacks on the existence of God, I would say quite the opposite. Saying the Big Bang, a massive expansion 13.7 billion years ago, that blew space up like a gigantic balloon, could have occurred without God, is a far cry from saying that God doesn't exist at all. Well, we all know the model of the universe being blown up like a giant balloon. What quantum mechanics and even cosmology does not explain in the least is, who's the guy blowing the balloon up? I don't think you can use science to either prove or disprove the existence of God, Filipenko said. Well, Amit Goswami can do that. And maybe our caller can. John, welcome to the program.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How's Vancouver these days?
It's been really wet.
Well,
we got people going kind of rangy because we haven't had a summer yet.
Well, you might not get one.
That's true. Okay, I just want to preface my call by saying, you know, I'm sort of hesitant to call because, in a sense, you know, I can't really... how do I say, like, your base of knowledge is far greater than mine, and it gets to be a little bit intimidating.
Oh, I don't want to.
I thought I would call anyway.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Okay. So one thing that prompted me is when you're talking about the Big Bang, one question I ask myself is, what time did the Big Bang occur? Was it 12 o'clock? Was it 1 o'clock or what?
Well, that's a good point. Most people would say it would be zero time, that there was no time before the Big Bang occurred, because time, from a cosmological point of view, is just distance. So really, theoretically, before the Big Bang, there was no distance.
Do you run into problems with that, or is that fine with you?
Only in the sense that when I consider that the universe is everything. In other words, if I'm inside the universe, if I'm inside that singularity, then it becomes somewhat of a paradox. But what most early physicists did, and I tend to do myself, is step outside the universe and become an observer of the universe from the outside of the universe. And I realize that there are other universes, other bubble universes. Once you do that, then the set of energy that is this universe becomes negotiable.
That sounds a bit like being in a godlike position.
And you have a problem with that?
I don't know.
Okay. I don't think anybody should. I think what we have to realize as human beings is that we are sparks, embryos of the God consciousness. Yeah, we're limited because we're in a human body, but that's the idea. We're growing. We're learning. We're expanding. We're evolving.
Okay, if you want to go down that road. I'll just tell you my logic. I think there has to be a God because we're dealing with something and not nothing. That's where I come from.
I agree.
You know, we're having a conversation. There's something here. Something got created, and we're talking about it. So to me, it didn't happen, you know, because the laws of physics existed and produced it. I don't believe that.
Well, just the fact that there were laws, it's perhaps possible that it was divinity that set up the laws that allows universes to be.
Okay. All right. What I'm getting at is, having said that, that produces a belief in God, okay? Now, I've spent, you know, I'm 59, I've spent 3 or 4 decades trying to deal with a God separate from me. Well, that didn't work. So as far as I'm concerned, there's no God separate from the human being. And so what that leads you to is, well, if God is not separate from the human, then that means humans are the divine force. And you're God, I'm God, everyone else is God. So that's what I come to.
Well, at the very least, we're connected, integral to it. It is, you know, perhaps shaking to the pillars of humanity to say we are God, and it is not uncommon for religious people that I know to become, if not outright offended, to become defensive if one human says, I am God. But you'll remember,
I know. I run into that. I've lost a friend over that issue.
Lost a friend. And he didn't say he was God. He just said he was Son of God. And he lost all of it.
Well, the thing is if you don't say that, if you don't come to that conclusion, then the separation will always exist. And that's the problem I've had with it.
I totally agree.
To be perpetually separated from the divine source, I can't live with that. And so that's how I've come to this conclusion.
Yeah, but that was a point of evolution for you. You weren't raised knowing that. Once you figured out...
No, I wasn't. Absolutely not. I can't, you know, I can't say that I've had experiences, you know, that were divine-like. I can't say that. I've just arrived at it intellectually. Although I've heard of people that really are coming into their position of being divine creators, marvelous human creators, creating almost not exactly at will, but certainly closer to being, you know, the kind of victimized, put upon human that most of us identify with.
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about. But you know, even if you study, you know, the holy men, you study the words of Jesus. Just read just what he told people, what the record says that he said, what even canonized or uncanonized, it doesn't matter. He says the same thing. He didn't come here to tell the world of his divinity. He came here to tell us of our divinity. He tried to make us believe that. You obviously have been seeking your whole life. And once you stay on that path, you will arrive at the destination, which is not a belief. Yeah. It's a knowledge.
Well, that's exactly the fulcrum that I'm at. Because on the one hand, my mind says you got to be joking. You're God. Okay, yeah, that's really quite funny. on, you know, my mind. So I'm talking to myself, and I'm going, okay, all right, what are the chances of taking stardust, which is what we're made out of, and converting it, translating it, orchestrating it into a human body? Like, what would be the chances of that? Well, intellectually, not very good, but you and I and everyone else are doing that. We're taking stardust and creating a human body out of it. Like, how incredible is that?
I mean, come on, we're taking a Big Mac, a large fries, and a 32-ounce Big Gulp in there. I mean, come on, we can turn shit butt into eye tissue. Of course.
Well, okay, so that's what I'm getting at, and so I just thought I would phone in, and that's about, you know, as much as I can convey at this point.
I think it's wonderful. I think you and I should go to the SETI 3 conference, and
all
we
right.
should panel, and we should say, by the way, I know you all are, God is not in.
Are you inviting me?
Hey, yeah, if I go, you go. Come on, let's
I'll go, and I'd love to go with you.
Well, I think it would be great. I will look up when the next SETI conference is, the SETI 3 conference. This one was, I don't know where it was. It just says here. These guys were from University of California, Berkeley, which probably is self-explanatory. I don't need to tell you what an oxymoron is, but okay, that, I'm far enough with that.
Military intelligence, that'd be one.
Yeah, found missing. I watched the movie, what is it, Incredibly Loud and Dangerously Close or something like that with Tom Hanks, and this brilliant, brilliant boy-child actor just did a marvelous, marvelous job in this movie. And they used to have oxymoron wars between them where they would hurl oxymorons back and forth. I had to listen to
it
several times with headphones on because it was so well written. The screenplay for that film was phenomenal. But I have to admit, the film would have gone nowhere without the absolute gifted acting job that that boy did. An amazing movie if you get a chance to see it.
All right, I'll put it on my list.
All right, John. Listen, I really appreciate the call. You made this section on the Big Bang just light up.
That's Oh yeah. Like my original question was, what time did it happen?
Well, it was probably before watches were invented, is what I was trying to say.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. It's like if you ask that question, then it sort of puts the whole concept of time. Under suspicion, you know, like the way we're ruled by time and our belief in time. If you ask the question, what time did the Big Bang happen? Well, it makes no sense. And so, like, our notions of time and our belief in time, I think, are really a problem. And by asking that question, I was trying to, like reveal the problem that we have and the way that we're screwed up as far as our belief in time goes. I think we're on a false premise here. I can't quite get a handle on it, but I know by asking that question, it sort of immediately reveals the absurdity of it, and that we do have something we need to kind of resolve regarding time and how it might be a false premise.
I think that there will be lots of discussions this next week as people listen to this archive, as people are late to work and going to talk to human resources. They will say, you know, time is relative, and really we should divide up time into moments rather than seconds and minutes. And I'm actually right on time when you compare this to the Big Bang. I think it would be a fun conversation anyway.
That would be, yeah.
All right, John, I appreciate the call.
All righty, we'll talk to you later.
All right, thank you so much. It's our good listener friend, John from Vancouver, always brings a brilliant viewpoint and consideration. I do want to let you know, Earth Explorers, never to feel intimidated to call in here to X Squared Radio. I love you, and I love your perspective. And you don't I don't necessarily have to agree with you, and you'll find me that I'm rarely disagreeable. In fact, I do get criticized for not being disagreeable and not taking some of my guests apart limb to limb, limb from limb, but that's not my job. Here at X Squared Radio, that's how this program got its name, because everything put into the function of X Squared is positive. Well, that is, except one number. If you're a mathematician, you know what I'm talking about. It's the imaginary number. It's the square root of negative one, otherwise known as I. I try to keep me out of the equation, and that way everything comes out positive. So it's not my point of view against your point of view. I will try to qualify your point of view, and I will not let you get away with making a false or unsubstantiated statement here, not meaning that I will contend with you, but I will arouse your faculties to understanding a greater perspective, perhaps. So never be afraid to call in here. It's not a confrontational program at all. It's where the past meets the future, right here, X Squared Radio. That's the whole purpose. That's why it's not called the Brooks Agnew Show. And that's why I never call it a show. I call it a program, because that's what we do here. We talk about and discuss the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. We try to bring the science to bear as much as we can, and those of you that have been listening to this program for the 7 years that it's been on the wonderful, glorious, web-dominating BBS radio network know that. Those of you that have heard me on other interviews, whether it's Carrie Cassidy, Coast to Coast, Freedom Link Radio, which I was on the other day with my great friend Chris, or Earth Radio down in Jacksonville, Florida, you'll hear the same thing. We approach things from a scientific point of view. We're open-minded. We try to bring as much knowledge and as much perspective as we can to bear, to create understanding, to create awareness, to empower the people that listen to our words here, yours and mine, so that they can place themselves in the universe, time and space, to reap the bounty of the universe. That's what we're here for. Now, I want to talk about something controversial, as though we haven't already done that tonight. This article just happened to hit the newspapers again, because our associate Julian Assange is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy hoping for asylum in Ecuador, and they're considering it, although they're also considering the ramifications. The reason that Julian is holed up there is because Sweden is trying to get an extradition to get Julian from London back to Sweden to stand charges for sex crimes. Now, before we go one more sentence beyond that, I want to let you know, Julian Assange is probably a busy guy. He's probably not very likable on a personal basis, but he definitely has several sets of crosshairs on him. And one of the easiest ways to compromise and get to someone like this is for him to have a deep interpersonal relationship with a woman. As far as I know, he doesn't. But he does love women. And so when he was in Sweden, he paid for, legally, two prostitutes. And he did have sex with them. And he was not wearing a condom. Not that they minded at that time, but somebody knew that he had done that, and he didn't wear a condom, which can be a crime in Sweden. And so that's the sex crime. So when you hear those words associated with his name, I want to let you know he made a legitimate transaction legally in a state, in a country that allows that kind of activity. He paid for it. He peacefully, in a very gentlemanly manner, I'm sure, had sex with these two women, and he was not wearing a condom. They didn't resist. It was consensual. They exchanged capital, and he left. And these are the grounds that the U.S. government are trying to assert to get him from London, which does not have an extradition treaty with the United States, back to Sweden, that does have an extradition treaty with the United States, so they can get him here and put him in prison. Why? Because Julian Assange is the spokesperson for an organization which chooses to remain anonymous, that has released hundreds of thousands of vetted, factual, minimally redacted documents and sources, including email communications. Everything is truthful. Everything is factual. Everything is real, released to the public, so the public can see what these people are doing behind closed doors. The darkest, most murderous, most conniving, sneaking, evil activities that have ever been conducted on the face of the earth. Hundreds of thousands of people killed, bulldozed into graves, burned alive, assassinated, beheaded, shot en masse, gassed. All of that information that has been released to the public is true and factual, and it pissed the people off that actually did the deeds. Julian Assange did not do the deeds. He just revealed the facts that the deeds were done. And I have maintained on this program before, and I will again, governments cannot have secrets. People do, but the more secret governments get, the more dark and nefarious and murderous and assassination-minded that they get, the more their own people are held hostage. Only the truth will set you free. And that is why, here at X Squared Radio, we officially and globally nominated Julian Assange for the Nobel Peace Prize. He is far away and above the winner of that award. No, it's not been awarded. But if it were within my power, I would vote it. And I would make sure. And I'm here to tell you right now my point of view, my personal point of view. And if you have a different one, I'd love to hear it. 888-429-5471. That Julian Assange should release the rest of the documents now. Go ahead. Pull the plug. Let all the sources out now. Let's find out what we did. Let's find out what someone did in the name of the United States of America, in the name of the British Empire, in the name of Saudi Arabia, in the name of Libya, in the name of Russia. All of these countries are afraid of Julian Assange, and even more, he's just the spokesperson. He has already sacrificed his life. I have seen him on numerous interviews. He is eloquent. He is honorable. He is truthful. He is factual. And he already knows he has given up his entire life. He can have no meaningful life, no family, no wife, no children, no grandchildren, no nothing. Just the legacy of truth. That's all. He's already done that for this organization called Anonymous. But there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in this leaderless, nameless organization that have enough information to put people like Holder and Obama and others in prison for life. The things that these men have done, the things that they have authorized to be done, have murdered civilians around the world, inside and outside their own countries. And the documents are there. The ones that have been released incriminate the people who are in them. None of it's made up. None of it's invented. It's all factual. And it's about time the truth got let out. The truth, get it out. Purge the system. Fire the people that are responsible for it. And let's forgive and forget and move on and become an evolved people. Julian Assange for Nobel Peace Prize. That's our vote here. One more thing. The bottom-up plan. You've heard about it in the news. It's something that we've talked about for a couple of years on this program. I don't know how this happened, but Obama has claimed credit for the bottom-up plan. U.S. President Barack Obama told a campaign rally in Florida Friday, the country needs some middle-class out economics, some bottom-up economics. Jeez, that's word for word. Anyway, Speaking at Hillsborough Community College in Tampa, the president said the economy is growing following the worst downturn since the Great Depression, but it needs to grow faster. He said what's holding back growth is a stalemate between two fundamentally different views in Washington about which direction we should go in. I hate to tell you, Mr. Obama, but you can't end a sentence in a preposition, okay? And the stalemate is not between two fundamentally different views in Washington. It's between two fundamentally different ideologies in Washington. It's between the agency government and the elected government. Anyway, he told his audience, Republicans, including presumptive president nominee Mitt Romney, believe that we should go back to the top-down economics of the last decade. Not true. Anyway, be that as it may. They figure that if we simply eliminate regulations and cut taxes by trillions of dollars, then the market will solve all of our problems. Well, that's pretty much it. They argue that if we help corporations and wealthy investors maximize their profits by whatever means necessary, whether through layoffs or outsourcing or union busting, that it will automatically translate into jobs and prosperity that benefit all of us. That's a true statement. I believe we should do everything we can to help our entrepreneurs succeed, the president said. I want our companies to be as profitable as they can be, but that alone is not enough. Because the central challenge we face right now, the challenge that we've faced for over a decade, is that bigger profits haven't led to better jobs. Bigger profits haven't led to higher incomes. That's true. Not for the people that work in those companies, only for the people that own and manage those companies. That's true, Mr. President. Those words are truer than true. The president said American prosperity has always come from a strong and growing middle class, and all those people who are striving and working to get into the middle class. We don't need more top-down economics, he said. What we need is some middle-class-out economics, some bottom-up economics. Well, that is straight out of the book, Mr. President. I totally agree with those words. $867 billion pumped into billion-dollar international companies, multinational companies, was not the way to stimulate our economy. We already know that. We know $9 billion pumped into green energy only created, into wind energy alone, only created 910 jobs. That ain't much. That's a really, really bad record. But it also was your record. Had you followed what you just said, we don't need more top-down economics. What we need is some middle-class-out economics, some bottom-up economics. Had you taken your stimulus funds and provided it to small business, American-owned, veteran-owned, women-owned, minority-owned businesses here in the United States, you probably could have created a job for every $200,000 put out there in the market. Because those small businesses would have bought equipment, would have hired people, would have bought buildings, would have made product, would have got it out there on the market. Now, I'm not saying give them all the money to get going, but be the risk partner. Be the person that gives them that 10 or 15% equity in that company to get their foothold and get them going. Yes, some of those companies will go broke. Maybe 90% of them will go broke after they spend all the money locally for cars and tools and buildings and tools and more people and inventory. And it would allow them to have competed against international trade, which you also failed to stop. Every single industry that we tried to excel in this country, China came in and squashed with cheap exports. We didn't tax them. We didn't tariff them. We didn't have trade agreements with them. Ambassador of Trade Ron Kirk was absent without leave. I met him face to face. I spoke to him. And he said great words, but he did nothing to help business in this country. Nothing. He went out. He met with us. He shook our hands. He told us about things. But he didn't do anything to help us. He didn't open the export-import bank. He didn't let us buy raw materials, open our factories, begin manufacturing our products. He didn't give us grants for equipment and tools. He didn't provide us low-interest loans so that we could put inventory on the floor and begin producing the products that we had invented, that we were doing here in the United States. No. Every dollar, every single dollar, went to billion-dollar multinational corporations that also just happened to be large campaign contributors. Your words are wonderful, and they're accurate, and they're right. We don't need more top-down economics. We need middle-class-out economics, bottom-up economics. Exactly right, Mr. President. Do what you say. Do what you say. Now, our phone number tonight, 888-429-5471. Sorry about that. Got a little carried away. 3 hours on The Voice. You're not supposed to push it that hard. Okay, here we go. Last subject, state sovereignty. Here's the definition. The supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable power by which an independent state is governed and from which all specific political powers are derived. The intentional independence of a state combined with the right and power of regulating its internal affairs without foreign interference. That's the definition of sovereignty. 40 states have now passed sovereignty acts. Some of those sovereignty acts in their entirety are copied and are printed in my latest book, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. You should read them because when you think of the state legislators, which are just neighborhood folks that happen to be serving at the state level, they answer to the localist of local politics. When you listen to their passion and you read the words of these sovereignty acts, you realize that it took a lot for these states to pass these acts, one by one, not a form letter, not by any means. Utah, Arkansas, Texas, Tennessee, read the words of these sovereignty acts, the declarations of these states. Sovereignty is the power of a state to do everything necessary to govern itself, such as making, executing, and applying laws, imposing and collecting taxes, making war and peace, and forming treaties or engaging in commerce with foreign nations. The individual states of the United States do not possess the powers of external sovereignty, such as the right to deport undesirable persons. But each does have certain attributes of internal sovereignty, such as the power to regulate the acquisition and transfer of property within its borders. The sovereignty of a state is determined with reference to the U.S. Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land. Hopefully, that's true. Now, one of the great drivers of commerce and U.S. economy has for a long, long time been the folks down at Wars R Us. Before I get into this, let's go ahead and take a call. Rusty from Georgia, welcome to the program. I hope we haven't lost Rusty. Oh, maybe we did. Rusty, try back, because your call is important to us. One of the things that drives our economy, and it drives it in a lot of senses because most of the investment money in new technology comes from the drivers for weaponry. Now, whether it's energy or whether it's lightweight materials or whether it's electronics or programming or whatever, most of the grant money comes either from software or from weapon and defense systems. Everybody knows this. The folks down at Wars R Us are always all the time looking for the next greatest thing because obviously if they don't, our enemies will, and they don't want to be unprepared for that. But we have seen over time that the folks down at Wars R Us don't really need a reason for war. They only need a weapon. Once they have the weapon, eventually they're going to use it. They'll find a use for it. That's why we have 30,000 drones headed our way, folks. Because the drone makers have been cranking out drones 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because there's money in it. $14 million a copy. Are you kidding me? Somebody's making a fortune off of this stuff. But now they have too many drones. Sorry, not enough war going on. We need to do something with them. Oh, that's okay. We'll fly them over the United States. That's what we'll do. We'll lease them out to law enforcement. Yeah, that's what we'll do. Well, the other thing is a noted fact, observation in the news. We only have a few minutes, so I'm going to cover this very quickly. It's a very disturbing statistic, and that is that more soldiers are dying from suicide than are dying from battle. And it's not because they don't have anybody to fight. It's because most of our soldiers come from our state's National Guards. They sign up for 2 weekends a month, 2 weeks in the summer. They're sold on the idea of a few hundred dollars a month and pay for education and help your community with a flood or a fire or a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake or something like that. You're a community helper. That's what you are. Well, they're coming back with their arms and legs blown off. They're serving 3-4 terms in foreign countries, killing other people. That's not what they signed up to do. They only wanted to be a weekend warrior. They didn't want to be a full-time federal soldier. They wanted to be a state militia member. They fly for the state of Texas. They drive a troop carrier for the state of Nebraska. They build mobile bridges for the state of Georgia. They are experts in energy and survival and power distribution systems for the state of New York. But they have been conscribed by the president to fight undeclared wars in foreign countries. And if they don't die in battle, they're killing themselves because they have lost their state pride. They were sold something they did not sign up for. And they want to be patriotic, but they're torn between the horrors of war and the bill of goods that they were sold on their state level when they signed up for 2 weekends a month and 2 weeks in the summertime. So there's a new act that's trying to gain traction. I want you to know about it. Okay? It's called the National Guard Deployment Act or Preservation Act. For the purpose of requiring the governor to withhold or withdraw approval of the transfer of this state's National Guard to federal control in the absence of an explicit authorization adopted by the federal government in pursuance of the powers delegated to the federal government in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 of the U.S. Constitution. Whereas under the Constitution of the United States, each state's National Guard is a defensive force controlled by the governor, but can be called up for federal duty by the federal government, provided that said duty is pursuant to the Constitution of the United States. And whereas Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 of the Constitution of the United States delegates to the Congress the power to provide for calling forth the militia. In three situations only: to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. That's it. Not to fight undeclared foreign wars in another country. That's the gist of the act. Whereas James Monroe, member of the Virginia Ratifying Convention, 7th U.S. Secretary of State and 5th President of the United States, wrote in 1815, "Congress shall have power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union." What laws? All laws. which may be constitutionally made, not the president. The president cannot order the governors to release their militias to him to place in foreign wars. Daniel Webster, in his 1814 speech on the floor of Congress, said, "The operation of measures thus unconstitutional and illegal ought to be prevented by a resort to other measures which are both constitutional and legal. It will be the solemn duty of the state governments to protect their own authority over their own militia and to interpose between their citizens and arbitrary power. These are among the objects for which the state governments exist. Now, therefore, be it enacted by the General Assembly, House, Senate of the state, of whatever state of this country, that the laws of that state read as follows. The governor shall withhold or withdraw approval of the transfer of the National Guard to federal control in the absence of a military invasion of the United States, an insurrection, or to repel invasions." That's it. Execute the laws of the Union. That's it. That is it. Hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, fires, floods, regional disasters. That's what the National Guard is there for. That's what they signed up to do. These moms and dads and sons and daughters do not need to be coming home by the hundreds of thousands with missing limbs, with psychological damage that destroys them and destroys their families. Now more of them dying through suicide than through actual battle. This must stop. It will stop. 40 states have signed sovereignty acts. It is now enough for a constitutional convention. It is now enough for an Athenian constitutional convention to be formed to pass an amendment to the Constitution that requires a formal declaration of war by Congress before state militias can be called up and sent overseas, without, especially under the War Powers Act, because it will be unconstitutional at that point, because there will be a specific amendment addressing it. Read the book, Alienated Nation. Get your hands on it. Get it into the hands of your state legislators. Get it into the hands of your congressmen and your senators. We have put several points out in this book. I have. And within hours of putting out this book, it started driving the headlines across this country. Almost every single chapter in this book is now being addressed in the headlines. Within hours of putting out the Control-Alt-Delete strategy, that is to say, repealing every single regulation made after December 31st, 2007, and starting over, this time requiring 2/3 vote of Congress to pass any new regulations. It is what is required to save this republic. If we do not do it, and we do not do it quickly, and the states now have the power to do it, it's in their hands. They can do it. If they don't do it, the agency government will seize control of the entire nation, all run by the executive branch. The complete balance of power will be upset and will be in the hands of one man, which the founding fathers saw coming and tried to prevent. It is now in our power to save this republic, and we must do it. This is our call to action. I'll see you next week. Next week I will be at James Gilliland's, but I may see you anyway. We may still do the broadcast Sunday night live from the Esetti Ranch in Trout Lake, Washington. Be there with us next Sunday right here on X Squared Radio. We love you. Thank you so much all across the world for being here with us tonight. If you're listening by archive, we love you too. Talk to you soon, my friends. Bye-bye.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.